question asked, are children learning?
Well, hello, everyone.
Hey, guys. This is Solving Systems with Jake Johnson and Nikhil Marda.
Yes, hello. My name is Jake Johnson. For those of you who don't know me, I am a high school math teacher from Rochester, Minnesota, John Marshall High School. I've worked here for, this would be going on 12 years now. I'm originally from Stuartville, Minnesota, which is a mere 8 miles down the road. I am married. I have 4 children. Wife's name is Molly. Kids, all boys, 4 boys in the family. 6-year-old Archie, 4-year-old Huck, 2-year-old Fletcher, and what is he now? Maybe 3-4 months old, Wally. And I've been teaching specifically AP Calculus for the past 6 years. I've been teaching AP Calculus BC for the past 3 years now. So, Nikhil, why don't you tell the audience?
Yeah, so I guess I was in one of your first BC classes then. Second class?
Right. Second class, I think. Yeah, that's right.
So, yeah, I'm a senior here at John Marshall. I've been in the Rochester Public School System for 13 years, and I was born and raised here in Rochester. So I had Johnson as a teacher my sophomore year, and through a lot of our conversations, I kind of realized this would make a really interesting podcast, I think.
Agreed.
Yep. The two of us talking about various things. Maybe we should explain how we came to this title.
Sure. So another thing that I forgot to mention in my intro is I've been fortunate enough to be the JM Math League coach for the past 2 years. Very successful team. A lot of great efforts over the past couple of years. And through those meetings, Nikhil and I have had numerous opportunities for just good conversations. Conversations about education, conversations about political issues, political topics, conversations about just the way systems work. And regardless of whether it was education or politics or just interactions on a daily basis, it seemed to us that, and I'll speak for myself, I guess, that the systems that sort of bind us together as far as schools and local and state and federal governments could maybe use some solutions, or at least posing the problems and thinking about if there are solutions, if there's one solution, two, maybe more, maybe none,
right,
that we can come up with. So that was what I saw as one of the starting points, but I don't know. Nikhil, what do you think?
We kind of came up with this name too as a clever pun, I guess.
Yes.
But you've got systems of equations, right, in math, and it's kind of the same thing we're looking at here. We've got a whole bunch of variables in play when we talk about these complicated issues, and by no means are we claiming to be experts on these things.
Absolutely.
But we just kind of want to talk through some of the things that we just normally talk about not being recorded.
Absolutely, yeah, and I think it's a great chance to explore possibilities.
Right.
And as you said, we're not experts, although, I feel like having taught for 11, 12 years now, I feel like I have something to say about education. You've been a part of the education system at the forefront of what we do for a long time, so I do think we have something to contribute to the conversation.
Right. Think at least a different perspective on Absolutely. Certain issues, yeah.
Yeah, perhaps a more analytical perspective.
Yeah, hopefully.
Hopefully, yes, yes. So?
Yeah. Also, let's just, kind of let our viewers know, or our listeners, know how the logistics will work here.
Sure.
We're planning on having episodes that are about an hour, and we're planning to record either once a week or once every 2 weeks.
Sure.
We're going to kind of bounce around from topics. We're not going to stay, doing education for 10 episodes or anything. We're just going to move around. Yeah, so let's dive into today's topic. We kind of were talking about this recently, and just kind of the systems that define education. And I think at the center of of designing any system for educational purposes is the classroom.
Sure.
I think, we may argue that it'll change over the next 10, 20 years, but as of right now, I still think where the learning happens is in the classroom.
Absolutely, and I think it's fair to say You know, it's funny because as a teacher, I hear from educational professionals and experts all the time about how the classroom will change. It's going to change in this way and that way. And yet it's interesting. I think it's just an observation that over the course of the last 100 years, how much has the fundamental structure of a classroom really changed? And I don't know if that's good or bad, but I think if you went back in time 100 years, how much different would it be? There'd be a teacher at the front of the room. There'd be students sitting in desks with pencils and notebooks. And the teacher would be attempting to fill students' heads with knowledge. The teacher up front in the room, the educational professional who knows everything, or presumably everything, that the students need to know, and the students just empty vessels waiting to be filled. So I think there's good research to show that that's not the best way to teach. And yet we keep doing it. And it's a question as to why. I don't know the answer, and quite frankly, I'm just as guilty as anyone of standing in front of a classroom and telling students what they need to know. And yet I can't help but wonder what the barriers are to that. Why do we feel so bound to it? Or is it just that is the best way to go? I don't know.
Yeah, so let's start there, specifically what you mentioned about teachers really just kind of talking at their students.
Sure.
So in between these topics, I'm going to kind of bring up what goes on in Johnson's classroom, since I spend a good amount of time there,
yep,
as Johnson can attest to.
Sure.
So recently you changed the layout of your classroom.
That's right.
Earlier, for the audience, earlier all the desks faced forward,
yep,
faced toward the board, mm-hmm, and now they're kind of turned inward. Is that a fair description?
Yeah, that's a fair description. Absolutely.
Yeah. And so now they're kind of in blocks. It feels like, mm-hmm, there are maybe like 6 regions of the classroom.
Sure,
maybe.
Pods, if you,
yeah,
will. Yeah.
Yep. 4 students each, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And was there reasoning behind that, or did you just want to try something new?
Yeah, so it goes back, the very first time I walked into a classroom, and I think I could speak for a few teachers as far as this being a fear is, most teachers are afraid that they're going to lose control of the classroom, especially early in your career, where you don't have all the tools in your toolkit, you don't feel like you're an expert, that you can really hold a classroom together. And there's nothing scarier, I don't think, for most teachers than losing control of the classroom, that the behaviors escalate out of control, that people aren't listening, that no one's paying attention. So I think one of the reasons for the more traditional desks in rows format is we want to make sure that students are not talking to each other.
Mm.
Because if students are talking to each other, then they're not listening to me.
Right, and you're the one that matters.
And I'm the one that matters. That's a well-established fact in traditional education, right? So I think what we've done is we've said, okay, you've got to keep control of the classroom. So in that model, we say rows. Set them in rows. Or maybe you stick the desks together, but they're still all facing forward. With still, maybe the goal there is to save space.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What I've found through my years of education, I don't mean to toot my own horn, but I don't really have problems with classroom discipline, classroom management. That has never really been an issue that I've dealt with that I feel like is a big concern. And I've learned that over the course of time, and I've started to reprioritize what's important. And I feel through just looking through how students learn and thinking about how people think, discussion is healthy. Student discussion and students talking is very healthy because, quite frankly, I've learned far more about calculus, teaching calculus,
mm-hmm,
telling other people,
right,
this is how I see it, this is what you might want to try, than I ever did sitting in a lecture hall in college. So to that end, the goal was primarily to get students talking more, to get them interacting and discussing and questioning each other in a healthy way. And through that, maybe build that inquiry piece up a little bit more and take the model of teacher at the center of all learning and maybe tip it on its head just a little bit. And that's tough in mathematics.
Yeah.
It's a very, if you go into any math classroom, for the most part, not all, but almost every day you're going to see rows facing forward.
Mm-hmm.
And the message that's sent to students is, go sit down, listen, write what we say, and reproduce on a test, which I think is questionable.
Right. So you mentioned that you haven't had problems with students kind of, I guess, being off topic or or discipline issues in general.
Sure.
Do you think that's a function of the class itself, the content, yourself being a figure of authority that more people respect? Do you think there's some other reason? Because, like, as a student, I've sat in on classes where it's pretty clear that the students don't respect the teacher, and at the same time that seems to be causing discipline issues.
Sure. I mean, I think respect is at the center of it. Mm-hmm. I really do. I'm not overly strict. I don't think I'm certainly not an intimidating figure. I don't work through threats or a perceived position of strength, but I do expect a lot of my students. I do, regardless of if it's freshmen or seniors or anywhere in between, I expect my students that when they come to class, they're there to learn. And I make it very clear to them that if they're not there to learn, then they need to find somewhere else to be. Because, like I tell them, you're not chained to the desk. You're not forced to be here. You're choosing to be here. Whether there are consequences that come with not being there, sure, that is true. But if you're choosing to be in the classroom on any given day, my hope would be that you would be there to learn math. And I think that comes through in what I say and do, but I don't know.
For the audience, another piece of information that's, you know, related to what's going on in the classroom, I think it was at the end of December, and our semesters go until the end of January for some weird reason. It's another topic.
Another topic. Another day, yeah.
But at the end of December, with a month left in the semester, I was sitting in a Calc class in which you told all the students that if they didn't want to show up, mm-hmm. they didn't have to.
Sure.
And you wouldn't, you know, go through the disciplinary process that the school has. You would sure. simply just mark them present.
Yep.
Because that's not a step that most teachers, I don't think, I've never heard of a teacher do that at this school.
Right.
So
here's, I mean, I think the most important thing in education is the relationships that you build with your students, bar none, more important than anything else. Because I think if you look at my lesson, it's pretty traditional. Mm-hmm. I think if you look at my tests, they're pretty traditional. Are they difficult? Yes, but traditional. Do we go fast? Yes, but not outrageous. I think everything that we do is well within the mainstream, how I teach a lesson, well within the mainstream of what you would expect to see in an average math classroom. So people often ask, because we've had some success, as you know,
right.
Nikhil.
And for the listener, I do want to point out, Johnson's AP scores have been, is it the highest in Southeast Minnesota?
It's certainly the highest in the district.
Okay.
We have a pretty large district. So the average AP score for the listeners in our AP calculus classes combined, average score is about 4.5.
Right. And for the listener, a 3 usually gets you college credit.
Yep.
And so it's basically saying almost every student that goes through Johnson's class, calc class, ends up getting college credit.
Sure. About 19 out of 20. Yep. 95% is our passing rate historically. So we have had success through hard work and, mm-hmm. and dedication. But with that success has come, people want to come see what we do.
Right.
So that's great. People email me all the time. Mr. Johnson, can we come in and observe your class? So this is teachers from other schools. This is instructional coaches. This is principals. People from other districts want to come see why. What are you doing that's working so well? And oftentimes, it's amusing to me that they will come in. They will sit through one class period, and they see what they see in their schools. And they're, I think, quite frankly, they leave unimpressed. They leave thinking, nothing special there. That's because you can't quantify a relationship-building exercise in one class period. And I think all of the fancy teaching techniques, all of the technology that we could possibly integrate into a classroom, all of the classroom management strategies and all of the training that I've received over the course of my career, which has been good and bad, both, I would say, None of it matters as opposed to the relationships that are built in the class and the respect that needs to be built and earned through being there for students when they need you and making students the priority number one. Because it is my firm belief that if a teacher, whether it's mathematics or social studies or English or Phi Ed or whatever it is, if a teacher makes it clear without doubt that student learning is their top priority and everything they do and say backs that up, students will walk through fire for you. They will show up at early morning study sessions at 5:30 in the morning. I can attest to that. They will put your homework on the top of their pile, even when they don't need to. And they will work and work and work for you like they wouldn't if you didn't believe in them. And I think that's something that that people have a tough time wrapping their minds around. That we need teachers in classrooms that are so dedicated to their cause that it is their primary focus.
So do you think that's at least partially related to what you teach? Because math itself is something where you can have essentially an infinite number of problems. Yeah. And definitely a large number of problem types, especially when you're teaching something like calculus.
Sure.
And there are other courses where you just simply can't have that material or that kind of learning that goes on. So do you think there's something to do with the content you teach?
Well, call me biased, but I think mathematics is one of the most naturally beautiful sciences that we have constructed or that we find, depending on how you see it.
Agreed.
In the natural world that we know of. So I think it does offer opportunities for people who appreciate it to come to the table and say, wow, this is wonderful. But I don't know. I think it's got to be possible. I'm sure it's possible in English, in social studies, in sciences. I think it's how you come at it, though. Mm-hmm. And does a teacher see his or her job as that of an information dispenser? Because, quite frankly, if that's the job of a teacher, that's the role of a teacher, we will be replaced. Because I am not nearly as good at disseminating information as Google, as Khan Academy, as online learning, fill in the blank, as an iPad.
Right.
If that's my job, I'm replaceable.
And so I think that really gives credence to the idea that it's the relationship that matters.
Absolutely.
These students are working at it way more because they know you care about them.
Yes.
And they also know that they have students around them that care. Because I think a lot of learning that goes on in your class actually happens because the students themselves are willing to, you know, help each other, work together, and encourage everyone to, you know, show up for 5:30 a.m. study sessions.
Absolutely.
For the audience, I guess, these study sessions are what, weekly about?
Basically yeah. Weekly, yeah. Whenever a test comes up, test or quiz.
Right, and the attendance rate is ridiculous.
Yeah, it's not...
Almost everyone shows up.
Yeah, it's not a couple of students straggling in. They wait at the door, right? Because our the security system is sort of... what would you say? Taken offline, yeah. Taken offline at 5:30, and the study session starts at about 5:35. So with that, at 5:35, when I go up and open the door for the students, we've usually got a nice, healthy herd of people waiting to get in to learn calculus at 5:35 in the morning, which is beautiful. But I agree, it does go back to the relationship piece. Because without that, and there's something too, I think there's something to knowing that other people are going through something similar to you. Mm-hmm. I think that's a very human emotion that we want to have, is the feeling of connectedness. The idea that I'm going through something that someone else is going through. That's why, to go a little off topic, one of my favorite holidays is Halloween. Because there is a set of... On Halloween, there is a set of norms and expectations that people can wander in the street. They can go out. They can knock on people's doors. They can feel like they're a part of something bigger. And is it a grand scale thing? Well, it happens across the country at every city. If you go to Louisiana, or if you go to New York, or you go to Oregon, or you go to Minnesota, on Halloween night, generally speaking, you know what to expect.
Right.
There is a social contract almost.
It's a ritual almost.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. And I find that to be connecting in a way.
So, I mean, I recently read a book called The Power of Myth. It's not really a book, but what they did is they took a conversation between, it's Joseph Campbell, who is a pathologist, and I think Bill Moyers?
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, so in the conversation, one of the things that Campbell said that really kind of stuck with me was he thinks one of the biggest problems in society is that we're losing our myths. And specifically, we're losing our rituals. So I think Halloween is one of these examples of something where you have something that binds people together, right?
Yes.
Because you're all taking part in something that's the same. And he goes on to point out that he thinks the lack of rituals are causing, you know, people to turn to gangs, for example, because they have, I mean, they have symbols, right?
Sure.
And they have initiation ceremonies.
Clothing.
Yeah. A whole bunch of things that make them feel connected because they're doing the same things. So in a sense, it's kind of like your class is a gang. It's a cult.
Almost.
And I would actually make that statement, like, honestly, here at JM, it really does feel like that.
Yeah. Well, and then think about this. And another thing that perhaps the listener should know about me personally is I do not own a cell phone. In the age
of... And this
of,
is going to be another topic of conversation for sure, but
sure.
Yeah.
Okay, so I won't go too far in depth.
I'll make a note of it right now.
Fair enough. So I think it's... and it's interesting because probably a fair number of our viewers will be... listeners will be listening to this through their cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
And yet... with all of these technological devices, with Facebook connecting the world is their goal, with Twitter and the ability to communicate at any time with almost anyone in the world, do we feel more connected? Are these attempts at connectedness making us feel more connected with each other? I would argue no. When I see two students walking in the mall together. They're with their best friend, the person they choose to spend all of their time with, and they're both on their phone, flicking upward to find something else to look at.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a connected experience? I would argue no. And yet you can take a classroom full of calculus students with no iPads, no cell phones, no Wi-Fi, just markers and a board, and you can create a very connected experience. And I don't know what it is that binds the people there. I think it's fair to say that a common goal with a common purpose with people who care is very, it brings people together.
Right. I think your classroom has kind of created a culture of always challenging students, I guess, but more of making them feel like they're a part of something bigger.
Yeah.
And I think that really lacks in a lot of other classes.
Sure.
Because with your class... it's something that students talk about years later. And word keeps trickling down to younger students that you want to be a part of this group.
Sure.
It really is an exceptional group of people.
Yeah.
I would say the group of people that go through your calc class really are the people you want to associate with at the school. I honestly believe that.
Agreed. And then I think the counter argument that I will hear from some people is, well, you're just taking the smartest,
right,
the most elite math students and sitting them in a class where the content comes naturally. I can tell you for certain that is not the case for all of our students. Of course, students like Nikhil, who is, by the way, if we can talk about Nikhil a little bit, a fantastic mathematician who has, well, let's just leave it at one, multiple awards at both the state and national level mathematically. And is to be commended, and quite frankly, in the future, we will see great things from. Students like Nikhil, I said, well, yeah, you've got a bunch of Nikhil Martas in there. Well, actually, no. We do have students who are extremely gifted mathematically, who enjoy mathematics a great deal. But I think it's gotten bigger than that. I think the classroom culture, as you stated, has become one where students want to be there. They don't necessarily even know why. You know, we joke. I have 5 class periods that I teach, and I have a lunch, I have a prep, and then I have a duty hour. My third largest class is currently my prep hour. When students show up for sometimes mathematical work.
But usually not.
Usually not. So they're just choosing to be there because they get the sense of connectedness. That's my opinion. And it's not just for the mathematically gifted, any more than an English classroom needs to be for, you know, Rhodes Scholars and authors. But creating those pockets of connectedness for all of our students and widening those opportunities, I think, needs to be a goal of education. Mm-hmm. Needs to be one of the things that we strive for, where students feel like, why would I want to be anywhere else? Right. My students joke, to go back to our early morning study sessions, they joke about being exhausted and being tired. And yet if sleep were more important to them than this calculus idea, or probably the idea of being connected mm-hmm. with their peers, they would be in bed.
Right. And there are people, there are many people who show up to your study sessions. Okay, many might be a little strong, but there are a lot of people who show up to your study sessions who really don't need it.
True, absolutely
true. And that's something that I don't think would happen if it was another, if that culture wasn't there.
No, I agree. If it were simply checking off boxes on a resume, mm-hmm. if it were just, well, I've got to get my A, I've got my right. A, you're right, they wouldn't be there. They are there because they feel like they're a part of something. And that's something to be cherished, something to be valued.
Yeah, and turning into the classroom too, I was reading some article about communities in general, and one of the things they stressed is that there should be a meeting place, always, like a location. Like, there were some things they listed. One was there should always be a location. There should be a role model that people look up to and feel like they respect. And I think both your classroom and you yourself serve those roles.
Yeah, and let me, just so the listeners don't think I've got a massive head above my above my shoulders, I make it clear to my students, this, what we've got in our classroom is not about me. It's about the students believing that they can do it. Mm-hmm. And that I'm there to assist them, that I am there to aid them, that I will do whatever is in my power to make sure that they are successful. But it's like the people who come in and visit, and they say, wow, you know, what is Mr. Johnson doing so well? They can't quite put their finger on it. It's because I'm not doing anything particularly amazing. There's nothing that you say, wow, I've never seen that strategy before. I've never seen it done that way. It's because, and part of it is we've got a track record now of being successful, but right. I can go to students and say, if you show up, I can basically guarantee that through your hard work, you will be successful. And that's not something that can be said in all classrooms.
No, definitely not.
So is there something special about the room? Yes. Is there something special about Mr. Johnson, the calculus teacher? I would argue not really. That it's really the system that is producing students who are prepared for their calculus test, prepared for college, and prepared to go do great things. Mm-hmm. And it's less about the math. It's less about Mr. Johnson, and it's more about their buy-in and their right. willingness to put in time and effort.
Yeah, and when we talk about systems, like, this really turns back to, you've created a system, a culture in your classroom that really just breeds success.
Yes, and it's fascinating when I hear, because I hear from my colleagues, especially in math, we've got too much content. We can't do more. We've got all of this stuff to cover, and yet somehow, with a dedicated group of people, and that's really what it is, mm-hmm. when the students are dedicated, it's amazing what you can get through. You don't need 51 minutes every day, bell to bell, of Mr. Johnson talking about math to get through an entire year's worth of calculus content. And as a matter of fact, we are able to, after my brief lessons, finish by usually mid-February. Right. And then we've got the rest of the time to review, refresh, refine what we do. And that wouldn't be possible if we didn't have a group of motivated people. There's no doubt. But it is somewhat striking to me that there are some teachers who, and I think it's the own limitations they put on their students, say, well, we're going to need, 10 examples of this. We're going to need 5 examples of that. Well, that takes time.
Right.
And really what they're attempting to do, in my opinion, is spoon-feed the kids information. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a big fan of spoon-feeding information. I'd like to see the students think on their own, whether it be on the homework, whether it be on the exams, whether it be on their AP test. They're going to need to think on their own. And that goes for the same as life, right? You've got to be able to think on your own. You're not someone. There's not a manual for life. There's not a manual for all of the things that could possibly come up. All the little situations. You can't possibly know every single problem that will arise in the system. You need to be able to think about the overarching ideas and apply them in ways that matter. Right. And I think that goes for any system, right? That goes for solving any problem is, can you generalize a solution that makes sense for as many things as possible?
So let's talk about generalizing solutions, I think. Sure. So you mentioned earlier, we've been doing Math League now for 2 years. And for the listener, it's been an interesting turn of events. Before Johnson took over as coach and before, I guess, I had any involvement in making the team something to be proud of, my first 2 years, the team was coached by a Spanish teacher just trying to hold the team together.
Sure.
There was no advisor in the math department that was willing to take it on.
No.
And we were bad. So bad that a team usually consists of 8 people, and at the last meet of my sophomore year, we had 4.
Yes.
So from that, in a year, we went from 4 people to over 40, and we went from being quite bad to not only qualifying for the state tournament, but also taking 4th in the state.
Yes.
And for the listeners, Math League is kind of, it's this competitive math event where teams of 8 basically represent the school and compete against other teams solving difficult math questions and kind of challenging themselves outside of the classroom.
Absolutely.
And so that turnaround is something that I think really does tie back to how not only you first created a culture in your classroom, and I think that same culture was recreated in our school's math team.
Yeah, well, and I think it does go back to when I first was hired at John Marshall High School. This is way back, right? I wasn't even married yet, quite frankly. It's been so long. I got one interview when I was looking for jobs. It was for John Marshall High School. And I accepted because this is the place I wanted to come. And because I saw it as a fixer-upper at the time, especially mathematically, which was, I would say, the level of pride with our students and their math background was different. Mm-hmm. It was certainly less, and it was more confined. It was we had great graduates. We've had great graduates before Mr. Johnson came here, and I didn't create great graduates when I showed up. But I felt like our school had a reputation, and I think anyone who's gone to John Marshall High School recognizes the fact that we have a reputation.
Yeah, for the listeners. Actually, I guess I can just tell this part of the story. When I was in 8th grade, my parents were, you know, we live in the John Marshall district, but my parents were very hesitant about sending me here. So much so that they wanted, there are 3 schools in our town, they really wanted me to go to another school that was far better known for its academics. And now, looking back on it, I'm very grateful that that didn't work out.
Sure.
Because I think the reputation that our school has gotten is not accurate, but it definitely still has a reputation of being the weakest school academically.
Absolutely.
And it's dishonest, but those things take a lot of time to change.
Yes, and that was, from the outset, that was one of my goals, was to change the perception and therefore change the reality of what our school represented. For a long time, we were known for athletics. We were known for, quite frankly, being a bit on the rough side. But when you walk the halls of our school, I don't think there are any students who feel like they're not learning what they need to learn to be successful at the next level if they choose that. But it's been doing some things really, really well. Getting those AP scores up where people have to take notice.
Mm-hmm.
Getting the graduation rate to a level where people have to take notice. Getting our Math League team to a point where people have to take notice at the state level to say, who is this John Marshall High School?
That was a great feeling.
It was.
I mean, we were at the state tournament last year, and people had seen us in the scores. We were seated like 6th or 7th, I think 8th actually, going in.
Yeah.
No one expected us to place and tie one of like the perennial champions in this competition. So just that transition just to shock everyone. Everyone had to ask, who is Rochester John Marshall? No one has ever heard of us. And it was a great feeling just to kind of shatter that reputation.
Absolutely.
And change, I guess, not only if people had heard of us, but also to give us that positive reputation among some of the top schools in the Twin Cities area.
Absolutely. And I think it goes back to, if you ask any of our graduates, students who I know, they're proud that they graduated from John Marshall High School, and they're doing amazing things.
They are.
They're doing amazing things in the workforce and at universities. It's just getting the word out. It's being proud of the fact that we are an academic school and honoring those things.
Right. So I wanted to turn it back a little bit to the thing we were talking about with Map League and how the culture changed there.
Yeah.
I think there's something really similar to what happens in your classroom. I think when you took over and I started caring about the team, there was a big buy-in.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was that these students who were in your class, a large part of them, were already invested in Calc.
Yeah.
And it was very easy to get them invested in Math League.
Yeah.
It was the same thing, really, because it was still you were around.
Yeah.
And it was doing math in your classroom. I really think it was because it was in your classroom that it made a big difference to that culture. Because people already associated positive things with your room. They associated learning with your room. So it was just a natural extension of that.
Yep. No, I agree completely. It's interesting because going back to last year and even this year, there are many of the top teams in the state that are made up of individual students who are just fantastic mathematicians. You've got eight great mathematicians on a team, and they do very well.
Right.
Our team, while everyone is very bright, everyone's very intelligent, and they work very hard, it's not like they have this long history of doing competition math. So how is it that we are competitive with those teams? I mean, how can that be?
Right. And I think it's really because people care about the team. Mm-hmm. Like, we look at, like, the top 10 teams in the state. I would say 9 of them have people who care more about their individual performance than the team's performance.
Sure.
I honestly think we're the only team that puts the team first.
Yeah.
And I think it's reflected in how our performance comes out. Yes. We have one or two individual state qualifiers a year,
sure,
while some of the teams of our caliber have 6, 7, 8.
Yeah.
But somehow, when one of our students does bad, which then takes them out of the running individually, they rebound back at the next meet, even though their individual score is tanked.
Right.
And when someone does bad, they feel bad not because they hurt themselves, it's because they let down the team.
Absolutely.
I think there's that responsibility to you, to me, to the rest of their teammates.
Yep.
And I think that's the same thing that happens in your class. When they do poorly on a test, I think they feel bad more because it's not about their grade, really. It's about they've let you down.
Yes.
They've let their classmates down, too, by falling behind.
Agreed. And I think that's one of the things, if we look at how a classroom could possibly function more effectively, is getting rid of some of those external motivators that we think will drive kids, that they care about their grade and that's why they're going to work hard and go to the mat for you, that they care about some reward that they could receive. I think it's more about the internal motivation that drives people to really do great things. I mean, you can get people to do things with external motivations. Okay, the grade matters to you, so do this. The grade matters to you, but can you get them to do great things? Can you get them to go above and beyond what maybe they thought they were capable of doing? I don't think so.
And I think you need that internal buy-in, that internal motivation.
Absolutely. If it's going to be sort of that life-changing, life-altering situation, they say, wow, that was, I'm really, really glad I was a part of that. Not just because I got an A or I got a B. There are some students who have 4.0s or near 4.0s when they come to me, and they're happy to get a B or a C just because they're proud of the effort they put in to get that letter grade. It represents to them.
It's meaningful.
Absolutely.
Because there's a story behind the letter.
Yes.
It was the 5:30 a.m. morning study sessions.
Yes.
It's not difficult tests.
Yeah, it's not the cookie cutter A where the study guide was just like the test and I just regurgitated information. They feel like they earned that B. They're very proud of that B. And you're right. It's the story that goes along with it.
Right.
So I think that's another thing that makes a classroom system work is that internal motivation, which can drive people to really achieve and succeed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
let's turn from some of the more, I guess, abstract ideas of a classroom to some of the more physical.
Sure.
Let's talk about the actual creation of the classroom, how you lay things out.
Sure.
And for the listener, here's something that's interesting. There are numerous studies that show that natural lighting is good. You want natural lighting in your classroom.
Sure.
And I was reading on the internet, and a lot of teachers were suggesting that one of the best things they could do would be increase the natural light in their room somehow.
Sure.
And what's interesting is that your classroom, Johnson, has no natural lighting,
none.
Even though you are right by six windows.
Yes.
You close all of them and just turn on one light in the back, basically.
That's right. Yes. Yeah, I can speak to that, certainly. So I used to, in my early days, I was a believer. You know, I have the windows open,
right.
Give the students a chance to bright, happy atmosphere.
Yeah.
And yet I found that the benefits of having the windows open were far outweighed by the potential pitfalls which could occur. Things
like
distractions. Mm. Things like sun shining in students' eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Things like, it sounds silly, but even if there are any external threats on the building, if that were ever the case, I don't want people to be able to see into my classroom.
Right. Because your classroom is toward the side where people can enter.
Yes.
So.
And the biggest thing is that I want my classroom to be about is learning.
Mm-hmm.
Learning mathematics. Having the windows open has never really, to me, aided in that effort. And quite frankly, it's pretty amusing because we do have those front two banks of lights off.
Right.
As we learn. And the students, maybe right away, it's kind of dark in here, but we get used to it, become acclimated. So that when I turn those front two banks of lights
everyone
on.
Everyone gets mad.
Oh, everyone's mad.
I can attest to this.
No, they're outraged. So if a substitute teacher is in the room,
yeah.
They naturally walk into the room and they turn on all three banks of lights.
And the first student who walks in.
Turns off
yep.
the front two. Every single time. Yep. So
you should put it in your sub notes, to be honest.
I should, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, keep the front two banks of lights
right.
off.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I probably should. You're right. Because, yeah, it's one of those things that I also find it calming.
Mm-hmm.
I find the environment, I want the environment to be welcoming and calming. And having those windows open has never really
helped. So something that's interesting there, I think, is your room is more constant than if you had the windows open.
True.
Because when the windows are open, there are things going on, so you've added this extra variable in this system,
True.
Right?
Absolutely.
You eliminate that variable, which may have some effects, but, I mean, clearly performance is still okay.
Yes, yes.
But by changing that and by establishing something that's always the norm,
yes.
when a student walks into your classroom, a lot of the basic things are just expected.
Yes.
Right? And I think when you eliminate the basic things, having to worry about those or being distracted by them, then I think you can do better things.
Yes. Another thing, I mean, if we're talking about constants within the system, getting rid of variables,
mm-hmm.
I think one thing that needs to be spoken to as far as teacher preparation is being ready to start at the beginning of the hour.
Hmm.
We've all sat in classrooms where the teacher, for whatever reason, is not prepared to start the class immediately. Perhaps that's how they choose to run their class. Perhaps they're just running behind. But there always seems to be a different beginning of class.
Right.
I think it's important as we look at what a classroom could look like, when that bell rings. Now, I'm not saying I use every minute, and we've spoken about this, right? We don't. We don't use every minute necessarily to talk about calculus.
Time.
But starting on time.
Yeah. Sends a message.
Yeah, it sends a message
right.
to the students that this is the place where we come to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And if we finish in 20 minutes, great. If we finish in 10, great. If it takes us 50, okay, that's fine. But that time at the end is maybe time where we can reflect and opine and spin off and go in different directions. Maybe it's time that we work on our homework. Who knows? But that beginning is a very consistent setup.
Right.
And when I work with my ninth graders, it's critically important that every day when they walk in the room, there is something for them to work on the board.
Mm-hmm.
Because if not, a student says, well, why do I need to be here on time?
Right.
Why does it matter? So having that is, I think, a good expectation and eliminates another variable that could be a hurdle to some students being successful. Would it be a hurdle to all? No. Would it be a hurdle to some? I don't know. But it might be a hurdle to one, and one is too many.
Mm-hmm.
We can't take that chance. We can't take that risk.
Right. So speaking of things being a hurdle to a few students,
mm-hmm.
Our district has tried to push the iPad agenda.
Yeah.
Trying to put iPads in a lot of classrooms or increase the technology in classrooms.
That's right.
And you've resisted.
I have.
And we've spoken a lot about this in the past, but
let's be clear.
Mm-hmm.
So before I am pegged as a total anti-technology person,
no phone, no iPads. What is
no
this?
iPads. He doesn't embrace any technology.
The microphone's the most technology he's ever had. Let's be honest.
That's true. I think I'm getting used to this, but we'll see. I was one of the original when the iPad pilot program came out, and John Marshall High School was just starting to look at iPads in the classroom. I was one of the first four teachers to say, yes, please, sign me up. I went to training. I learned about how to use them in the classroom or how not to use them in the classroom. I was on board. I felt like this could be a game changer, that this could be what pushes us over the top, that we'd be pushing our classroom that we spoke about before, how the classrooms become so stale. It's the same thing year after year after year. So I was on board. And so I had them for 2 full years. And we had people at the district level and the building level.
What years were these?
Oh, let's see. I'm bad with dates.
Maybe, it was before me, right?
Yeah, it would have been. Yep. So maybe
so like
I'm
4 or 5 years ago?
Yeah, probably
so not with
11,
your...
12, something like
okay,
that.
Okay, so not with your calc classes.
Maybe
then.
The very first calc classes
okay.
that I had.
And what did you use them for?
That's a great question. It's the question I had for district level people, for building level professionals. Mm-hmm. So we have people in our district that are technology implementation associates. Their job.
Fancy title.
Their job is to make sure that technology is implemented in the right way, because they recognize that it has been a hurdle for teachers in the past to implement technology successfully. Because if you're just given this wonderful, in air quotes, technology, and you don't know how to use it, it's not going to work. So they meet the need. When I met with these people, there was never anything that they could show me, provide for me, no tools that I said, wow, that's a game changer. That one pushes us to a new level of education. It was simply replacement for things that we already do in a more expensive, less efficient, and quite frankly, less reliable
right.
way than I currently had in my system.
Mm-hmm.
So the only thing it did, in my professional viewpoint, was add distractions for students, create a less reliable system of delivering information, and collect dust in
right.
the back of my room. So in the end, what happened was another teacher agreed to take them, and I am iPad free now.
And distractions specifically, the district did a student survey where they asked students who had iPads on a daily basis what they thought of them. And of course, this is an underreported statistic, but apparently 10% of students said that it distracts them.
10%.
And of course, we know the number is larger, but let's just roll with the number of 10%.
Sure.
If in your class of, say, 15 students, mm-hmm. if even one student was distracted by something
sure.
that didn't improve the educational quality too much,
right.
you would remove it.
Absolutely.
Right.
And I certainly wouldn't pay $300 to $400 for that device.
And like $100 of upkeep a year, it's ridiculous,
precisely.
Right?
Precisely. Yes.
But...
Well, and to take it even further... Most teachers would say, well, class sizes of 15 is optimistic. I have a class of 30.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. 10% of 30 is 3 students. If I went to my boss and said, listen, Mr. Lindbergh, 3 of our students, they're not going to be engaged today. Right? We're just going to take those 3, I'm going to put them off on the side. They're not going to hear what I have to say today. That would be unacceptable to him. And I agree. It's unacceptable. And yet with iPads, for some reason, because we believe in their magical powers.
That's a good number then.
Right. right, then that's great. Wow.
Only 10%?
Only 10%. Wow. Isn't that fantastic? And yet, I still have not seen a study which indicates, no professional research to indicate that iPads improve student achievement. I've never seen it. It might be out there. Again, I'm not claiming to be a statistician or someone.
Empirically, we haven't seen it.
I've never seen it. Right. It might be there, but it feels more like a corporate endeavor than an educational tool.
And I also feel like when you have three students in a class of 30 distracted or having some other means to get their education, maybe, you're ruining that culture that we've talked about. I think that relationship between the teacher and the students is now a relationship between the student and their iPad.
Absolutely. And if we want to talk about what's an acceptable level of distraction, imagine if I had one window open where the sun was glaring in and blinding only one student, couldn't see the board. Would that be acceptable? Would I accept that as a teacher, as an educational professional? I think most of us would say no, that's absurd. You would find a way to remove that distraction, precisely.
Right.
So finding a way to remove the iPads is pretty simple. Find someone else to take them. Yes.
Yes, absolutely. As you can confirm.
Yes. It's the same with the Wi-Fi not working in my room.
Right. This is an interesting point for the listener. The Wi-Fi in this building is pretty bad in general.
Sure.
But not only is the Wi-Fi just non-existent in your room, cellular service is also terrible.
Quite
basically
spotty.
Like no technology that connects to the outside world works in your room.
Yeah. That's right.
So I think it's interesting because at the start of your class, at least, and I'm guilty of this too, the start of other classes, I'm on my phone.
Sure.
And when the bell rings, I'm still on my phone. I put it away when the teacher starts talking.
Yes.
In your class, the phone's away when the teacher start, when you start talking.
Sure.
And I think that goes back to the culture that you were talking about with starting at the bell. The bell signifies learning.
Absolutely.
Right.
And I think, and the hope is that when students walk into the room, that they understand the rules of the system that we've created, which is this is a place to learn. And a phone, while a useful tool,
definitely is.
I don't deny that at all. And there are many students who look up my answers on my blog. There are many students who access extra worksheets and things through the blog that I've created through their phones. It is not the primary tool for learning and engagement. The primary tool is the relationship that I have with the students and that they have with each other. And in my opinion, a phone doesn't take place of that. Now, do students create AP calculus, study groups outside of class? Yes. Do students have sort of AP calculus Facebook groups set up? Sometimes. Are there chat groups for just, 1 hour or these group of people? Yes. Is it the primary mode of connection? No.
It's your classroom.
It's the classroom. Mm-hmm. It's a place, it's a common location where people understand the rules, they understand the expectations, and they know that when they come there, they're coming there for a certain reason.
Right. They understand the system.
They do
and
understand.
And they know they're a part of it and they're proud of it.
Absolutely. And they should be. That's a system that is working. It's working in a healthy way.
Right.
With the people who are engaged in the process. But eliminating variables that are impediments is important for any system, no doubt about it.
Right. So I think that's a good stopping point.
Okay.
I do want to point out a few things to the listener. First, I really hope you enjoyed listening to us talk for an hour.
Absolutely.
So we'd like to hear your feedback. If you've got questions, comments, thoughts, we discussed some things where we said we weren't experts. We'd love to hear something there.
Absolutely.
And we'll, if we receive something that we want to talk about, we'll definitely mention it in the next episode.
Any corrections?
Corrections too.
Sure.
If you've got a personal story, we know that some of our audience will be alumni or colleagues of Johnson or friends of mine.
Yep.
So if you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at solvingsystemspodcast@gmail.com, and we'll get back to you or we'll incorporate it into the show.
Absolutely.
I hope you guys enjoyed the show. Anyway, as we wrap up this episode, I want to give thanks to a few people who have been a part in this production. I want to thank Katie Holzer for a lot of the production and editing that's going to go into this. The beautiful logo you see on the Apple Podcast Store was designed by her. So thank you. I also want to thank Ben Durstein and Drake Thomas for a lot of the suggestions that have come into not only topics for this episode, but for future episodes. So if you want to get in touch with one of them, you can also email solvingsystemspodcast@gmail.com. And from all of us, thank you for listening and stay tuned for more.
We appreciate it. Thanks a lot.